Okay, so for everyone tuning in, we're doing something a little different on the podcast. If you're new to the show, welcome. I am your host and fellow producer, Carolina Gropa, and I have on the line with me the very lovely Sarah Bakken, who is my associate producer. If you guys were at the event that we had, our kickoff event a couple weeks ago here in LA, you got to meet her in person and see her beautiful face bumbling about. And here she is. We recorded an episode together, so people know you.
Yeah, in theory, if you listened to that episode, yes.
Yeah, they should. They should. If you haven't listened to it, highly recommend. We dive deep into my story, my journey, and Sarah turns the tables on me and asks me a lot of the uncomfortable questions I often ask my guests. So,
yep,
highly recommend. But yeah, so we want to do these mini-sodes. We're going to try this out for the next month or two, where we're going to be stuffing your ears in your inbox, wherever you're getting your podcast. You can hear us talk more and babble on about different things. And we wanted to kick this off just with a short and sweet episode talking about some current events of this last week, discussion topics that we think are fascinating to us that we were texting about and we think maybe the listeners would also want to be in on it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for me, obviously, this weekend, Oscars weekend, huge deal for everyone across entertainment, whether or not you work in motion picture industry. It's just like one of the events of the year in LA, very fun. A fun little ironic moment for me is that I was stuck in Oscars traffic and missed the first 30 minutes.
Oh my God, where were you going?
West Hollywood. I have a friend visiting me this week, and she was invited to an Oscars party in West Hollywood, but we had come from shooting something together in La Crescenta, and there was no way to avoid it. I was like, I literally drove past all of the Cadillacs coming dropping off the celebrities. Like, which, fun fact, they store them all in the Hollywood Bowl parking lot. I didn't know that until I passed it in my car.
That makes sense. They have a lot of space, and the Hollywood Bowl is not in season around this time of year. So like, why not? Yeah. And they start setting up like a week before. Obviously, it's a huge event. It's always at the Dolby Theater, which is on Hollywood and Highland, where the Walk of Fame is, and very tourist trappy. So like, it is like a whole week of getting the town ready for this huge event that no one else outside our industry cares about. So,
yep. And one of the really fun parts was when I was driving past it, I was like, I wonder where the Vanity Fair Oscar party is, like that after party that everyone takes all those photos at. And then later on in my drive back to my apartment to watch the Oscars, I passed the Vanity Fair Oscar party. So yeah, it was just
where
a fun little, it was on Santa Monica in Beverly Hills at like this art center or something. Mm-hmm. Not at a hotel, but there was like a huge banner that was like Vanity Fair, like a floor, like I covered a whole wall of a building, like
amazing
tent setup. It was just a whole shindig.
Well, life goals are to be invited to the Vanity Fair party, even over the Oscars for many people. So, you know, that's what we're working towards. Not that parties or awards matter that much, but they are fun, and it is an honor just to be included.
Of course, of course. And of course, an Instagrammable moment just
yes,
for fun.
We need it. We need it. So what were some of your favorite moments from the night? Well, of what you saw, I guess.
Yeah, it's been like a minute since I've really embraced award season, but I really love this format of having like five past winners come out and give tributes to each nominee. I thought that was delightful. I really loved seeing the speeches for, like, obviously I'm a supporting actress, which I have to go back and watch because I heard Lupita's speech was just everything. But I loved the speech that was given to Sterling K. Brown. Mm. You know, like just the ones where it's like you could see the actors just really getting emotional, like when Sally Field did Emma Stone, and like I was even like a little bit emotional. Like I have no ties to any of these people, but I was like, how great is this? Like actors supporting actors, like people in this industry who, like, granted, these people make like millions of more dollars than I will ever see in my life, but just to see the camaraderie of like people being kind to other people, I feel like is something that is so lacking right now.
Yeah, and I think it is nice to, I'm sure there's still competitiveness behind the scenes. There always has to be, but hopefully it's like a healthy competition, right? And it's nice to see, especially for the women, I think, seeing other women, these giants of cinema, you know, up there giving praise and just saying incredible things to these other performers who maybe they've never met or worked with. And to, even though it's scripted, sure, but like, you know, they signed off on it. They're not just saying these things they didn't mean, I'm sure. These are top-notch people. So yeah, I agree. I thought it was a really beautiful moment, and I hope they keep doing that because I think it's a cool way. I think it's a smart way for them as well to make sure like previous guests who are not nominated, who have star power, are walking that carpet. Like I was seeing that Jennifer Lawrence, she hasn't been to the Oscars since she was 25. I don't know how old she is now, but I think she's inching a decade later, you know what I mean? I think she's like 32, 33. And so a lot of people were surprised to see her there. And I was like, that's really smart to just kind of bring back some familiar faces, bring that star power that everyone loves so much to the Oscars in a really cool way too. So
yeah, I loved that. And I also thought that there were some really creative moments. Like, first of all, everyone's talking about the I'm Just Ken performance.
Of course. I mean, how could you not?
Right. And then I go online on Twitter and had no idea that it was, the whole thing was a reference to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yes, to Marilyn Monroe's. Everyone, the song Diamonds Are Girl Best Friend, which people actually think is the title of the movie, is from this film, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. People actually think that the movie entirely is called that. But no, it's the song. Yeah, it was really cool how they did the tribute. And I love that Greta Gerwig, you can see, she had no idea this was coming. She was so like shook. And I love when we can get these like actual raw and real reactions out of people, especially when they are going through the press circuit and we're just seeing them, you know, do the thing, put on the face like they have to get through it all, and to have these like cool, real human moments. I just loved it. So cool.
Yeah. So big ups to the creative director of that performance. That was great. Yeah. And then I also loved, I mean, a lot of the times, you know, the presenter bits are like really cringe and like difficult to listen to when they try and like do like comedic banter. But I actually really thought it was endearing how they did the John Cena bit for costumes, where he comes out naked and it's like the importance of costumes. Like that was actually really fun and really smart.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that.
A few of my takeaways were Emma Stone's speech was just like beautiful. I don't know how she does it. You know, if it is just her being herself, or she's just perfected the craft of playing Emma Stone for us. But like, she feels so relatable. Everyone I know wants to be her friend. She just makes it feel so possible. Like she really is just this girl from Arizona who like worked really hard and like made her, you know, made her way. And it's just, I don't know. She's just got this like magic about her. And I love that she thanked her daughter at the end. Oh, it got me all verklempt. I was just like, not me crying. And I was watching with some guys who were like getting all emotional too over her speech, which I'm like, damn right. But I think the thing I loved about her speech the most was her reminding us about the beauty of collaboration in filmmaking, and how even though this is her award, she really shares it with all the people that are involved and are required to make the thing, which is something, as you know, I always talk about on the podcast. And so it's really cool to have her remind us during such a pivotal moment, you know, in her journey, that she's choosing to talk about that. So I was like, you go, girl.
Yeah, I loved that part of the speech as well, where she thanked her daughter, because the character of Bella Baxter in Poor Things, you know, starts like she ages over time, but mentally, but she starts out with the brain of an infant. And so I think having had that experience, and she said her daughter was just about to turn three, like having that, like, this is happening right in front of me, I'm just going to kind of emulate my daughter experience that you can put into a role, was so, so cool.
It's very cool. And I can't wait for her daughter to be old enough to watch this and be like, wow, my mom is such a badass. Though by the time her daughter is old enough to watch that movie, that also means, you know, it will be very old.
We don't talk about that.
We don't talk about that. I think Jennifer Lame, who was the editor of Oppenheimer, like I loved her fangirling hardcore, specifically about the producer, Emma Thomas, who was Christopher Nolan's wife, for those of you that don't know. And I love that she was just like, just so like, again, another normal human, as most other department heads are. They're not celebrities, but that she shouted her out was amazing. Having her be up there, her being Emma, be up there accepting the award for Best Picture around all these men, I was just like, yeah. It just made me feel so like, you know, really proud of a woman getting to share that honor. So that was a cool moment. And then I think Cord's speech, did you see his speech? He won for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yes.
Yeah, what did you think of it?
I loved it. And going back to Jennifer, the editor, for a second, Jennifer is her name, you said?
Yeah, Jennifer.
Yeah, her after the ceremony, her resume was trending on Twitter because everyone was like, "Oh, are we gonna start standing an editor? Like, this is like she's done so many cool projects." And I was like, "Yes, please! Like, let's start like looking really behind the scenes at the people who you know actually make these things happen." And like, you know, and not that you know the above the line you know performers and everyone don't make it. You know, exceptional, but like everyone below the line who has a hand, especially the editor, in making these things so cool. And speaking of below the line, before I go back to Cord for a second, I don't know if I missed this in the first half hour, but I thought we were doing Oscars for stunts and casting this year. Were those just not televised?
Next year. Yeah. Oh, they're starting next year. They were announced this year, but they'll be next year. And I don't know if they'll be televised either. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I mean, one step forward, right?
Because they reduced the sound design, the sound rather category significantly. Instead of sound design, sound mix, they combined it into one. Also, I don't know for what reasons. I think I read about it, but potentially to save time with the broadcast. So I'm curious if they'll try to keep it, you know, keep it tight. So
interesting. But yeah, Cord's speech was great. I still have not seen American Fiction. So
what
I know.
What are you doing
I
with
know.
Your life?
I
Get
know.
Out of your, go see it right away.
There are so many Oscar movies that I still have to see. Like, I think I've only seen like four of them. And there are so many. Like, I still haven't seen Oppenheimer. I still haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon. Like, the big 3-hour
ones.
You
gotta see it. You gotta see it.
I haven't seen The Holdovers. Like, they're all on the list. But, oh, I did just watch Past Lives, which you told me to watch. And that broke me.
It's beautiful. It'll break you and piece you back together in all the ways. American Fiction, which was produced by a past podcast guest, Jermaine Johnson, who's a manager at 3Arts. And actually, if you go back and listen to that episode, gosh, from 2021, a long time ago, he talks a lot actually about Cord and what success looked like, or something about like what he's been so grateful for in his journey. And he talked about how much time he's invested into these relationships, into some of his clients, and that, you know, for him, he felt like he had made it when he was able to like buy a house because his clients were doing really well, you know? So it's cool to hear his beginning journeys of working with Cord since the very beginning. And hopefully we'll have him back on soon, maybe with Cord, to kind of do a touch base. So
I would love that, because with Cord, I in his speech where he was saying, you know, taking a chance on someone who had never directed anything before, I would love to know like what that path looks like. You know, how do you go from having never directed to being up on the Oscar stage?
Yeah, I don't know if he directed any of the episodes of Watchmen for HBO, because he wrote a lot of those episodes. I'm not really sure if he directed any of them, but certainly it was his, you know, directorial debut on the feature side, which is, again, super impressive. But it comes from the power of the script as well. You know, I think he obviously wrote a really great adaptation and directed the hell out of it. And it was just that perfect alchemy, you know, right writer, director, right producing team, right vision, right budget, price point, frankly, and then right cast, like a lot of great people who are just really enthused to be a part of the film. So yeah, I hope Jermaine and Cord come on and we can talk more deeply about that. But I want to transition in using Cord, because he talked, you know, he urged studios, for those of you who haven't seen his speech, to diversify their risk. And instead of making one $100 million film that potentially flops, to make 10 $10 million films that could potentially do well, you know, just really diversify the financing, the spend. We need it now more than ever. And I actually shared this article on my socials yesterday that echoes like a similar tone, which is a New York Times guest essay called How Bad Can It Get for Hollywood by Mark Harris, who's a cultural historian and an author. And he basically talks about how, you know, the headline is a bit misleading because I think it comes across as like super negative, but he has some really great silver linings and takeaways. And I want to read just a few excerpts that really resonated with me, especially in light of what Cord had said. He said, in the summer of, he said, basically talking about how our art industry has persevered so much since its beginnings, right? And he talks about how in the summer of 1989, and I'm quoting him, prestige Hollywood movie making was in a rut, and anxious executives fretted that maybe young people just wanted to stay home and watch MTV, much in the way that now they worry that the youth are addicted to bite-sized TikToks. But in 1989, the success of director Tim Burton's Batman and the unexpected breakout hits of The Little Mermaid, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Do the Right Thing opened up new vistas of possibility. These genres that had been written off as marginal, you know, comic book movies, animations, and indies, became gold mines, you know? And so we're looking for that next thing. And I think audiences are smart, they're savvy, they're hungry, they're looking for it. But I think if executives keep making decisions just looking at data and metrics and they forget the heart of like taking risks and giving our tours, you know, this opportunity, we're never going to find what that next nugget is of the next thing. And there is a real fatigue around like the superhero genre, you know, world. And this article really dives into that. But he also said, if Hollywood were a big summer movie, we'd be right at the end of Act Two, at the always darkest before dawn moment in the story when all seems lost. Or as one agent put it to me, a lot of us are feeling like we're working in the aftermath of an industry, not in an industry. But as any fan of any Hollywood screenplay knows, this is also when the beaten down heroes look at the red-drawn battlefield, assess the new, heightened by the stakes, regroup, and eventually triumph. And the movie business, since at least the 1940s, has always defined itself by its perceived threats to survival. Charges of communist influence, the advent of television, the rise of VCR, cable, and streaming, and it has always found a way to rebound. So I read this and I feel, it's again, not to discredit the realities of the dumpster fire that is the industry still and the market correction we're still in and all of that. In fact, Deadline had a great sort of recap of the unity rally that happened last Sunday between IATSE and Teamsters, because obviously if those strikes were to happen, it would be a devastating shutdown to the industry once again, you know, and below the line jobs have been impacted, continue to be impacted. So it is bleak. It is bleak for a lot of people that haven't worked, gosh, in like over a year. That's just the reality. But again, I think this New York Times piece really reminds us that it's a slow build, but it is cyclical and we always find our way because we have to. We kind of have to fight for our survival, which is why I find it so bizarre, right? And I get it. Capitalism, foreign money, you know, Wall Street getting into Hollywood. It's like the priorities are not where they used to be. I understand that. But time and time again, the data proves that like when you take these risks creatively, they pay off and they can launch a new movement. They can like reinvent the industry a little bit. And so it always baffles me that like the big wigs, decision makers haven't really quite figured that out and still are so risk averse and so fear-based about everything, which is what I think collectively everyone is feeling right now. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, two strikes down, potentially two more to go. Like it's definitely been a really rough year for a lot of people. And I do totally agree with that sentiment that I would love to see more low budget films. Like when I look at the slate of like what's coming out at like the theater, you know, and I have like, I'm an AMC Stubbs member. Like it really does not cost me much to go see like three movies a week. And I'm finding myself not wanting to, which is really devastating because the movie theater is my happy place, but I'm just so uninterested in what's being produced right now because it doesn't feel authentic. And I don't mean like it necessarily in just representation. Like I mean, we absolutely need more representation around like pretty much every sector, you know what I mean? But like in terms of story, all the stories feel so manufactured now. Like all the Hollywood blockbuster stories are very formulaic, you know, like you know what's going to happen when. And I miss a lot of the nuance that comes when you see like a film like Past Lives, you know what I mean? Like that movie, how do you get that made? Like I would love to know, because I could see people at the top looking at that and saying, you know, maybe it's not really about anything. You know, there are whole scenes where they're just kind of looking at each other. Like, what is that? Like, our audience is going to get bored, you know, whatever that. But like, those are the moments that like break your heart, you know, like those are the moments that I want to see more of. And so for me, you know, I would like to see a lot more being produced for a significantly lower budget. Something else that article mentioned was like, now there's a tendency to shelve movies before they're even released.
As like write-offs, yep.
Which was absolutely crushing because I read, what was it? Coyote versus Acme, the movie, I think it was Warner Brothers or whatever it was that is now not coming out. I read the script and it's beautiful. It's so good. And it's really, really sad that that movie may never see the light of day.
I agree. And again, I think it's like all of these people coming into Hollywood has changed the landscape very much about what gets made. I actually last week had a date with my husband and we went to see The Player at Vidiot's here in LA. If you haven't checked out Vidiot's, highly recommend. They are a gem of a place that has been resuscitated. It's a live theater, not live theater, but you know, they have a theater where they do screenings of all kinds of movies and a lot of these classics as well. So it was so cool to watch like a movie from the early 90s in an audience full of people who a lot of them are fans, of course, have seen it. And there were a lot of us that it was my first time. And it's a beautiful Robert Altman film. It's a comedy and it's about our industry. It's essentially about a movie executive who a writer, you know, he thinks a writer is basically trying to blackmail him and threatening to kill him. And he goes on this spiral and it's just amazing. And it's like, you see all these cameos and all these faces and it's just awesome. But it made me sort of nostalgic for that era of Hollywood where it was like writers would pitch and executives would take a chance and ideas were sort of crazy, but somehow they worked, you know? Yeah, so I don't know. I long that we somehow get back to whatever this modern version of that is. But I think with so many things changing in such a drastic way and the industry having to create a whole new identity is what I think is bottlenecking and the fear that everyone feels, right? If you're an executive and you really want to take a chance on someone, but that could mean your job because you like we're betting on the wrong horse in the eyes of your higher ups. Like that's a scary place for some people to be, or most people to be, you know? And so I think that's why you see people that perhaps 5-10 years ago would have been all about it now be like, oh, it's got to have all the right elements. It's got to be undeniable. It's got to be fully packaged, you know? And what concerns me is like when these giants pass, who's going to be there to fill their shoes? Who's next in line?
I think that when the people at the top remember what it's like to be an actual fan of something they're creating, that's when things will kind of get back on their feet instead of, you know, betting on the 10th reboot of the movie that came out 15 years ago, you know?
Like, where is that creative thinking that's solution oriented instead of just, again, like, and if you have a CEO of a studio who is bringing only a corporate financial POV to everything they're doing, and that's trickling down to everybody, how would you feel empowered to be like, I love movies, I'm a fan of movies, but like my hands are tied, you know? Executive friends of mine are like, everyone's like, the new line is like, survive till 2025. Have you heard that? Like, it is scary out there. Some of my executive friends are like, we'll take meetings, we'll hear pitches, but we're literally not allowed to buy anything, you know? So it's like, Everyone's just kind of like pretending to work. It's this weird thing, unless you're the 1% of people who have to be working because those movies are huge properties and you have Timothée Chalamet and they gotta go, you know, whatever. So yeah, so I hope that this article, which I'll share, we'll link when we share the episode, that people read it and it gives them a little bit of inspiration, a little hit of that.
Yeah, definitely.
So to wrap up, and not to end on a sour note, but I do want to talk about the Rust verdict that came out this past week regarding the armorer Hannah Gutierrez Reed, and they found her guilty of involuntary manslaughter for the 2021 shooting of cinematographer Helena Hutchins, which happened on the set of Rust, which is an indie Western film, at the hands of Alec Baldwin. And this is very sad, you know? I think that, like, it's just the whole situation is just heartbreaking. It's literally, like, when you think about it being independent, putting something together, your love, all the things to get something into that production phase, which is so hard. And then to have something like this happen, I mean, it just, like, it just blows. I don't know how else to say it. Like, I put myself in the minds and positions of some of the people who probably had nothing to do with it and had no fault in the matter. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, I don't know. It's like there's no way to point fingers at any one person, but how any live bullets would end up on a set is just like beyond me. And how all of the systems of checks and balances to make sure that weapon was treated with care properly and, you know, handled with the utmost regard and respect for it being a live weapon is wild to me. So I'm just curious at how something like that bypasses all of the checks and all of the hands of the people that should have been making sure that this was safe, you know?
Yeah, I'm super confused because I have been following it since the beginning. And apparently, and I mean, don't quote me on this, but what I read was that they had found 6 live pieces of ammunition on the set after the police came in and did a thorough search. And I've never been on a set where weapons, false weapons have been used. So I don't really know. I'm not as familiar with the process, but I know that, you know, there is a line of at least like what, 3 or 4 people that are supposed to check the weapon before it gets in the actor's hands.
Yeah.
Do you know what that process is?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the size of your production like anything else, but typically once you have a weapon, a live weapon on set, even if it's something that is going to shoot blanks for the way it's going to read on camera, etc., the armorer is coming to handle that weapon. You know, they are having safety meetings with the first AD, with the director, with the cast, with anybody involved in that scene, to make sure everyone's aware of what they're doing and the risk. Sometimes depending, there's a stunt coordinator involved as well. Certainly producers are all over that because again, it's a weapon. It's scary. Even when you see a fake prop gun on set, I think in light of mass shootings and all the things that have been happening in our world, like people are on alert and it does put the crew in a certain position. But of course you can't shoot a Western without guns. Like I get it. But yeah, the armorer would have handled that weapon. They would have checked and made sure it was filled with the correct blanks. They would have brought that safely to set. They would have then, when it landed on set, they would announce, we have a hot weapon on set. You know, we have a live gun on set. It's usually placed in one position. Only one person is allowed to touch it, depending on, again, the project. It's the armorer or a props person. They are the sole person then responsible for handing that weapon to an actor who's then going to, you know, use it. But at every step of this, if it's exchanging hands, like somebody is checking and showing you, the armor should have been like, hey, here's the thing. I'm going to open up the barrel of the gun, show you that these 6 bullets are, you know, blanks. And I would assume blanks look different than normal bullets because that's a huge safety concern. Producers would also be around for this moment, a first AD, like people would be watching this unfold. And so that's why it's hard to point fingers. And it's so conflicting because I feel so much for this armorer who was there, especially learning that her dad was actually like a movie gun coach. It's like, what? The irony of that is like a movie alone, you know, that the article says that she's relatively inexperienced, you know. Also, again, it's like when you do these low budget projects where you're strapped for money and time and you have to hire less experienced crew for a variety of reasons, these are some of the things that can happen. And it's not to say it couldn't happen on a bigger studio project or with more experienced people, but I mean, I've been a part during COVID. The amount of like safety guidelines and checks and balances and meetings we had to have about protocol and testing procedures, like, and it was unreal how they treated COVID. And it's like, how come those principles are not being as rigidly applied to every other part of safety on sets?
Right.
I'm sure it is on the studio level, but again, on the independent side, it's easy to not have this in place because you're not beholden to a guide of how a studio expects you to do something, which is why it's so important to make sure you have experienced people in that dichotomy of like, yes, you want to give opportunities to people that are coming up, but you have to make sure they're stepping into the right opportunity that's enough of a lift and of a challenge from where they were, but that ultimately it doesn't put the production in a place where something like this could happen because it's never worth it. That's why it's like you give green PAs maybe that opportunity, but you wouldn't give that to many other positions because again, if anything happens, it always goes back to the producers. You are responsible for delivering a film safely, on time, on budget, and taking care of the cast and crew. You know, that's part of the production process. So it's hard to wrap my head around it. I feel so much for this woman, Hannah, and her father, and obviously for the entire crew who had to be there and witness this, like the trauma of that. Like, I just, the whole thing is just, yeah, just really bums me out. But
maybe I'm like naive, but I feel like we're at the point in our technological development that we could start using weapons that don't need gunpowder. Like, can we just have a create something that just makes the sound and then edit that in post? Like, what?
But some people are just, oh, we want to be old school about it. Oh, we want to have, because we're shooting on this way, we want to see as the gun fires, you know. And practically sometimes it is cheaper to do that than in post, but you know, there are reasons why people would make this decision over the alternative. But I just agree. I think that at this point, any gun that has any real gun should just never be allowed on set unless it's truly a prop that never has bullets in it. And it's never going to be fired. It's like I'm opening up my dad's gun that he handed down, family heirloom type of thing. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There just has to be an improved system on the other side of this. So,
Hear, hear.
And, you know, hear, hear. And I'm curious, the film was resurrected last year. They finished filming with Alec Baldwin back. I don't know what DP stepped in to complete that film. But I know the film is complete and has been on the market looking for a buyer. So I'm very curious to see, like, who wants to touch that? Like, can they spin this into some interesting thing? Is it even a good movie? Like, I think, honestly, just for the sake of Helena, I think it's important that her work gets seen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get that it's like a tricky, slippery slope, because then you are rewarding this team and these producers for like a film that was not handled with care, you know?
My guess is we'll hear something after Alec's trial is done.
Yeah, after the trial for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. Thanks for joining me for this mini-sode.
Yeah, this was fun.
I appreciate it. This was fun. I hope listeners got some good stuff out of it. We'll link all these things in the show notes and in our, what do you call it? The link tree bio, in the bio of the socials. And yeah, we'll be back with you next week. So thanks so much for tuning in and doing this live thing with me and with Sarah.
Hey.